Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. I can be found easily on Twitter at @Brother_Andre, and you can look me up on Facebook. Just Google, or rather search on Facebook for Brother Andre Marie, and you'll find me. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. That's bam@Catholicism.org. Tonight's show is episode number 122. And I'm calling it Not Beyond Good and Evil. Not Beyond Good and Evil. And, of course, the title is a ripoff of a book by Friedrich Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil. What am I going to be talking about? I'm going to be talking about some thoughts contrasting Catholic notions of good and evil with various erroneous notions of the same. And, of course, since good and evil is wrapped up with ideas of God and religion, since it's also wrapped up in the idea of morality and various constituent parts of morality, right and wrong, virtue and vice, and sin, since such questions are all wrapped up in notions of good and evil, I think that this is something that is worth commenting upon. And it's also worth noting that these are subjects that are filled with lots of controversy. So when we talk about evil, we're talking about a problem. Evil is, of course, a problem. And the problem of evil is one of the two arguments against the existence of God that St. Thomas Aquinas considers in his Summa Theologiae, the other argument against the existence of God being the seeming sufficiency of secondary causality to explain all that exists. This second objection, in brief, is what modern atheistic materialists advance. These people that say, oh, you know, we don't need to postulate the existence of God to explain everything that is. Science can tell us about why things are. Science can tell us how things came to be. Science can explain it all. That sufficiency of secondary causality, that is the modern atheistic, materialistic objection to the existence of God. And St. Thomas answered it in the 13th century. But that first one is what concerns us now. That first problem, the problem of evil, the existence of evil. Towards the end of the show, I hope to actually quote St. Thomas's objection and then the reply he gives to the objection, because it is profound. The problem of evil was, in a sense, exaggerated by certain dualistic sects like the Manichaeans. Now, Manichaeanism, it was a Christian synthesis or a Christian syncretism with Persian dualism, with the religion of the Persian Empire, which still exists to this day. It's called Zoroastrianism. And the Zoroastrians, who basically were persecuted in their native lands, I guess, of Persia, which would now be Iran and Iraq, the Muslims didn't exactly treat them very well. However, it also spawned a particular version of Islam that is different, because if we look at the Islam that's practiced in Iran, we see Shiite Islam, and the Shia are quite different than the Sunnis in some of their beliefs. And a lot of this is from the fact that Persian dualism, Zoroastrianism, didn't exactly fully die, and some of the ideas did get absorbed into Shia Islam. But as it met with Christianity, as it synthesized itself with Christianity, it is known as Manichaeanism. And Mani was a person. He was a Persian monk. So he was right in the heartland of Persian dualism. And he was a Christian monk who came up with his own ideas concerning good and evil. And he took the Persian dualism, which had Ahura Mazda and Ahura Man being the good God and the evil God, the good principle and the evil principle, and he made this into the Christian God and the Christian devil. Now, you might say, well, so far so good. What's the problem? Well, the problem is that Ahura Mazda and Ahura Man are equal in power. One is the creator of all that is good by way of spirits and souls and such. The other is the creator of all that is evil, meaning matter. So it's a dualist religion which sees matter as evil. So Manichaeanism was a Christian heresy which synthesized these two things, Christianity and this aberrant religion, this pagan religion, which was dualistic, having God and the devil being basically equal in power. And the other problem with the dualism is that matter is therefore evil because it's the creation of an evil God. And there's something of a seduction to Manichaeanism in a lot of false religion. There are even his close disciple, Philip Melanchthon, accused Luther of Manichaean delirium at times. This was Luther's heresy became very obsessive about evil and the nature of evil. Luther himself became very obsessive about evil and the nature of evil. And if you know something of his personal life, you know why. He couldn't get over sin. I mean, he had serious moral problems, and he didn't take the proper means to get over those problems. Ultimately, he settled on the notion that basically sin doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect my relationship with God. So therefore, you know, he sort of called a truce with sin, and kind of gave in. And if you give in, it really doesn't matter. Gnosticism, too, had some tendencies in this order. The Gnostic heresies and Gnosticism itself tended to talk about good and evil in such a way that that evil didn't really matter. For the Gnostic, there were two ways of dealing with this. Evil was a problem, and therefore it had to be eradicated. So some Gnostic sects became extremely ascetical in their effort to stamp out evil, ridiculously ascetical, far more ascetical than Christian asceticism is, which is balanced by a proper notion of good and evil. So some Gnostic sects, on the other hand, and we see this in people like, just to give a modern example, I saw his name the other day in the news, believe it or not. Apparently, there's just recently been a documentary made about him. But the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, whom anybody who was around and alert during the 1980s, who paid attention to the news and stuff, would have been very aware of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and his free love cult that had taken up abode someplace in out west in some tiny little town, I think in Oregon or Wyoming or someplace. And they basically hacked off and alienated all the ranchers in the small town that they invaded. But the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was this alleged holy man from India who was a complete fraud, but whose Indian sort of Gnostic, typically Gnostic, pantheistic religiosity basically was what they call a sex cult. I mean, these people had no concept of moral goodness. And it was a really disgusting and debauched cult based all around sensual pleasure. A lot of Gnostics in the old days, the real Gnostics, not the ones that were in it for the money like the Bhagwan was, they were the same way. So you had Gnosticism, which tended to be very ascetical, saying, okay, evil's a problem. We stamp it out. We eradicate it. We subdue every human impulse towards pleasure that might lead us to evil. So you have this ultra asceticism. But then you had Gnostic heresies, which basically said, well, evil doesn't matter. It can't hurt us. So they indulged every passion. And of course, that never works out well. So you had these bizarre excesses, two opposite extremes of moral behavior, all stemming from the same fundamental errors of Gnosticism. Well, the Manichaeans produced a similar sort of dualism in morals. They had the strict believers that were the initiates. They had been baptized, and they were actually the strict adherents of the sect. And they were extremely ascetical. They hardly ate. They ate, I think, 3 days a week they were allowed to eat. They never had carnal relations. Why? Because matter is evil. If you have carnal relations, well, you might accidentally get pregnant, right? And therefore, what? Well, then good spirits get enfleshed, get trapped in evil matter. So marriage was evil because sex was evil, and sex was evil because procreation's evil, because procreation is taking good spirits and enslaving them in evil matter. So therefore, sacraments can't be part of the true religion because sacraments entail matter as well as form, right? So and ultimately for the Manichaeans, suicide became a sort of something of a quasi-sacrament because it liberated the good soul from the evil matter. This heresy, as I said, had a certain allure to it, as disgusting and repellent as it is to any authentic Christian moral sense. It had a certain allure, and it came back in the High Middle Ages, in the midst of Christendom. It invaded southern France, parts of Italy. It was known as the Cather heresy. It's more popularly known by the name of a city in southern France where it seriously embedded itself, Albi. So it's called the Albigensian heresy. They're known as the Albigensians or the Albigenses. But it's a revival of Manichaeanism. So oddly enough, St. Dominic, who battled it, the early Dominicans battled this heresy, was fighting, in a sense, one of the same exact battles that was fought by St. Augustine. Now, St. Augustine gives us one of the great answers to the Manichaean problem of the reality of evil. Because if evil exists, and we all know that it does, what is it? What is its ontological status? Which, of course, leads us to explore the greater question, the more important question of what is good. So, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. So that's one of the wrong answers to the problem of good and evil is the Manichaean answer, which is to say that all good comes from the good God, all evil comes from the evil God. Both of them had a certain creative power. Okay. The problem of evil is insufficiently dealt with by the Protestant reformers, whose notion of the Christian life is not one of a transformation from evil into goodness, from interior unholiness to interior holiness, but rather it's a kind of a masking of man's evil by the merits of Christ. Now, this is most powerfully seen in Martin Luther's idea of forensic justification. What does forensic justification mean? Well, forensic justification is that Christian righteousness or Christian justice or Christian justification is not what we Catholics conceive it to be. That is to say that we are translated from a state of sin into a state of sanctifying grace by which we are interiorly renewed and truly made holy. No, it's not that at all. Man is a sinner. Man is born in original sin. And by the way, the early Protestants, especially Calvin, exaggerated the effects of the fall. They exaggerated man's status before the fall, and they exaggerated, therefore, the effects of the fall, so that the Council of Trent had to condemn such things as every deed of the unbeliever is a sin. Now, we Catholics don't believe that. We don't believe that everything an unbeliever does, a Mohammedan or a Jew or whomever, I mean, an atheist, and by the way, unbeliever in the sense that the Council of Trent would use it would have included heretics and schismatics, not schismatics, but heretics. It would have included Jews, even Jews who believe something, that is to say Judaism and not Christianity. An unbeliever is somebody who doesn't believe in Christ, to use the language of the Council of Trent, which would have been virtually identical language to Luther's. So Luther thought that, because he hadn't gone that far, Luther thought that all of the deeds of those who don't believe in Jesus Christ are sins. Well, that's absurd. You mean when a Jew provides for his family, that's a sin? You mean if a Muslim properly corrects his son for doing something evil, that's a sin? It's an absurdity, and you can see why Philip Melanchthon accused Luther at one point of Manichaean delirium, because he saw sin everywhere. Okay, so the Protestants had a very inadequate notion of good and evil, and they did not believe that sanctifying grace actually interiorly renovates the soul and makes us from unholy into holy. They didn't believe that. So for Luther, forensic justification is this idea, and this is Luther's metaphor, that man is a snow-covered dunghill. So a dunghill is a dunghill. However you want to describe it, however you want to, you know, slice it and dice it, a dunghill is a heap of scatological matter. But for Luther, that's us. We're all dunghills. But we're covered with snow, meaning exteriorly, we're covered with something that looks white and clean and pristine and innocent and so forth. So the snow-covered dunghill describes the Christian believer for Luther. In other words, still inside is still fetid, scatological, odoriferous waste. But on the outside, since it's had imputed to it the merits of Christ, it looks good. So God no longer regards the filth and the rot that still exists there because of this forensic justification. God now looks at this person and sees his son Christ. Now, for us, God really does, we do really believe that God looks at us and sees Christ, because baptism configures us to Jesus Christ, and it puts the image, the stamp, the seal of Jesus Christ on us. But for God to look at the justified Christian, he doesn't have to lie to himself in reality. He looks at us and he says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased," just as he could say to our Lord Jesus Christ. But he really is pleased, because there's really something pleasing. Because God's love, unlike our love, is creative, and it's recreative. God's love makes something that's unlovable lovable. But truly lovable, he's not lying to himself and saying, "Okay, that thing that I'm looking at now is really unlovable, but I'm going to go ahead and love it anyway." No, that's not the effect of God's love. God's love makes us truly lovable by imparting holiness to us and changing us. That's not Luther's concept. That's not the Protestant concept of holiness. That's not the Protestant concept of grace, at least not the original version. Okay. You're listening to Reconquest and the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be. This is Brother Andre Marie, and we are talking about not beyond good and evil. Now, the next false conception of good and evil that I want to talk about comes from Friedrich Nietzsche, the guy whose book I'm ripping off in the title to the show. Friedrich Nietzsche, in Beyond Good and Evil, enshrines a categorical denial of any universal morality and advances the notion that man ought to be motivated by power, Christian morality being a weak and effeminate slave morality that subjects man to arbitrary notions of good and evil. Nietzsche was an atheist who not only denied the existence of God, but he considered as mere bad human fabrications such notions as causality, succession, reciprocity, law, freedom, motive, and purpose. In other words, he was a madman. When you discount such things as causality, when you discount such things as law, in other words, it's not a natural law, everything's basically arbitrary. And when you discount such notions as purpose, which, if you discount notions of purpose, you're not scientific. If you discount notions of purpose, you cannot have an ordered and systematic knowledge, no matter how smart you might be, no matter how many books you might be able to write, and no matter how many opaque and bizarre sentences you might be able to string together in those books. You have no systematic knowledge. You have no true scientific knowledge if you don't believe in such things as purpose and causality. For him, everything was just arbitrary. And therefore, what exists when we're surrounded by arbitrariness? Will. The will to power. Grabbing power. That's what it was about for Nietzsche. And his Übermensch, the Superman, or the Overman, not the Marvel comic character, but the original Superman, is the man who casts off the limits of an enslaving concept of morality and seizes the will to power. That's the Superman. He's basically somebody who seeks what he wants by domination and achieves a certain Superman status over others who are content to be slaves. Because they allow them, because they create for themselves this slave morality, which is some sort of a consolation for them in this ruthless universe. But the true elites in all this arbitrary, non-caused, non-purposeful universe that exists, they seize power. So this is the philosophy of an utter madman, and it's part of the, I mean, Nietzsche was something of the philosopher of the Nazis. I don't think they thoroughly believed everything Nietzsche's, in fact, Nietzsche didn't thoroughly believe everything Nietzsche said because he was changing his mind. His thoughts, you know, developed over the years in such a way that there was contrariness to his, between his earlier and his later ideas. But this is basically what he means by beyond good and evil. The categories of good and evil, the categories of morality by which we normally express ourselves are something that enslaves man and limits his pursuit of power, which for Nietzsche, this is the summum bonum. This is the ultimate good, the pursuit of power, the will to power, as he called it. So that's one bizarre and evil outlook on good and evil. Now, of course, Satanists, both old and new, get the problem of good and evil wrong by essentially inverting it, by being on the wrong side. You know, they're in a sense pro-evil. They're on the side of the devil rather than on the side of God. Now, most modern Satanists are frauds in the sense that they don't actually believe in the supernatural or the preternatural at all. The real satanic creed, they see Satan as their hero simply because Satan said, I will not serve. In a sense, they're like Nietzsche. In a sense, they're saying, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to assert my own will and not going to be enslaved by some other will. I'm not going to have my intellect imprisoned by some system of thought that claims to have authority from on high. No, I will serve myself. I will put myself as numero uno. And in that way, they are certainly following Satan. Now, most modern Satanists, your Anton LaVey's and a lot of these guys, they didn't believe anything about the supernatural. It's just purely a show for them. But Satan becomes sort of a symbol of their struggle against religion and their struggle against God. Now, it's not worth wasting our time anymore to consider Satanism in real thoughts treating of good and evil. But there's a modern twist on the satanic, or at least on the occult, that reveals something of man's preoccupation with good and evil, and what becomes of his outlook on those things if the existence of God is denied. And this brings my attention to somebody that has come across my radar screen again lately, namely Howard Phillips Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft. He is a master of American horror fiction. He wrote lots of weird tales. He was a hero of Stephen King. Stephen King, I believe, called him the greatest horror fiction writer of the 20th century. And now, I mean, I'm not saying Stephen King's an authority on much, but I suppose he is an authority on horror fiction, since he is probably the most popular living practitioner of that particular craft. Lovecraft, it was an amazingly good writer. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with Lovecraft. When I was a young man, I was interested in reading some of his books. I read some of his stuff, and I fell in love with his prose. The man himself was warped. His own personal story, I think, largely explains why he wrote what he wrote. In brief, his father was some sort of a traveling salesman and married Miss Phillips. So Mr. Lovecraft married Miss Phillips, hence the Howard Phillips Lovecraft. And the HP is actually his maternal, his mother's surname. His mother's maiden name, I should say. This traveling salesman married the scion of a well-to-do Rhode Island family, and apparently the man wasn't the most faithful of husbands, since he ultimately ended up dying in an insane asylum. The insanity being brought on by untreated syphilis. So he was. Probably not exactly faithful when he was on his many sales trips as a traveling salesman. And this is a cause, of course, of great unhappiness, because the man died when Lovecraft was a child. And he was the only child. The woman saw the husband in him. Now, apparently she didn't know the cause, the real cause of her husband's death. She didn't realize what syphilis was and what it had to have been caused by. So she still had some regard for the father, who apparently sort of looked like the boy. And she would dress him in his dead father's clothes and things like that. There was something morose. She feared going outside of the house very much. They had moved to live in her own home that she had grown up in. And H.P. Lovecraft's grandfather, his maternal grandfather, became sort of a father figure for him. And the grandfather regaled the boy with gothic horror stories. So he got that interest early on. But what is more to the point here is that poor Mrs. Lovecraft, Miss Phillips, lost her own mind, and she ended up dying in an insane asylum when Lovecraft himself was 31 years old. It's a very sad story. He had lots of personal tragedies, and was a rather bizarre, withdrawn person. He had a serious fear of the beyond. He was definitely, they say now, xenophobic. He was a bit of a racist, as might be suggested by his poem, The Creation of Niggers. He was a very, very, in that respect, he was kind of a man of his age and of his social status, because he came from a rather degenerated sort of New England aristocracy. They had fallen on hard times. His maternal family had fallen on hard times. Eventually, they lost their fortune, and he had to live in sort of a ramshackle place that was stuffed with lots of memories of his well-to-do upbringing. So a lot of his stories have to do with rich people who have fallen on hard times. I think he becomes very autobiographical. But what does this have to do with good and evil? Well, his mom was a Baptist, and his maternal family were Baptists. I have no idea what his father's religion, if any, was. But he was in New England, and of course he would have been surrounded by Puritans. And a lot of his characters are Puritans. They are either serious Puritans who believe, you know, the Calvinist Congregationalist religion of New England, or they're degenerated ones, seriously, very warped people who become, you know, worshippers of demons and who let in the so-called elder ones into our dimension by worshiping them as devils. He had something of an obsession with the Puritans. Now, this is so. Imagine now, just imagine if you were a Puritan. Now, what the Puritans had almost a Manichaean worldview. Now, they certainly didn't give the devil equal power to God, but for them, creation wasn't good like it is for Catholics. Okay, keep in mind, these people didn't drink. These people did not have music, except perhaps some kind of music that was done in church. If you research indigenous folk music, indigenous, I don't mean the Native Americans, the Indians, but indigenous folk music of the different cultures in the United States, the different American peoples. So you have a culture of the Appalachians, which is quite unique. They have their own food. They have their own way of speaking English. They have their own customs. They have their own music, and it's actually very fun. You go to the American South, you have food culture, you have music, you have merriment, you have mirth. You have some version of that everywhere. You go to the Dutch who settled around New York. You have something similar. There are various cultures which settled in different places of the United States, and they all had their music and they all had their different cultures, except for New England. The culture was very bleak, and there is no native folk music in New England. Not the Puritans, not the Calvinists. They weren't into that stuff because, of course, if you have music, you might have dancing, and if you have dancing, you might have fun. And they were opposed to that sort of thing. I'm not being caricaturistic. This was something endemic to the Puritan mindset. It was a very bleak, dark thing. Now, if you were a Puritan and you had come here to the New World and wanted to sort of conquer it and saw yourself as the new Israel, the new chosen people who were going, and the Puritans did see themselves that way when they came here. They were going to conquer the evil people who were in the land, just like, you know, David ultimately conquered the Jebusites and claimed Jerusalem. They had a very Old Testament outlook on things. If you were a Puritan and you had this vast, unconquered wilderness, these dark woods that you lived in with long winters in New England, you might think that the woods were evil, spooky, creepy places. So a lot of New England literature and poetry from Puritans and fallen away Puritans has this darkness about it. So there's a darkness lurking about creation, and this is equated with sin and the fall and all that stuff. Imagine if you were part of that religion, and then you suddenly turned around and said, I'm an atheist. So you no longer believe in the good God, but what are you left with? You're basically left, culturally, I mean psychologically, I don't mean, you know, in your ideology that you've just invented for yourself. But I mean, you're a product of your culture, whoever you are, and you're stamped with it. So the New England Puritan is stamped with a certain Puritan outlook. He just is, and it surrounds him in his culture. I'm not saying he can't convert. That's not the point. But if you convert to atheism, what you're left with as basically a fallen away Puritan is the evil world. The evil world that you were brought up to not trust and to be a bit anxious about. You're left with the New England woods that can be creepy places where dark things lurk. I think this is part of the explanation of why Lovecraft's lore is so weird and why it's so evil. Basically, in his not in his actual philosophy and outlook, but in his literature, in his myth that he's created, which surrounds a lot of the different stories he wrote, there are these beings called the Elder Ones, who are basically aliens. They're not gods. They're aliens from some other dimension. And they're far older than the human race. In some of the stories, the human race is some sort of an scientific experiment gone bad of the Elder Ones. And they abandoned it and sort of let us take over Earth. But in their own dimension, they rule as lords and everything. But here's the thing. The Elder Ones are either indifferent to man or openly hostile. And they intend on breaking back into the dimension of Earth and taking it over. And, of course, doing away with man. So, and of course, apparently Lovecraft had this thing. He hated seafood. He could not eat fish. So a lot of his evil characters look like octopuses and fish people. So this is his way of dealing with the problem of evil. It's the stuff of nightmares. In fact, since he was a child, he was a man who suffered a lot of nightmares. Some of those nightmares just became his stories. In fact, at least one of his stories is just his own transcription of a nightmare he had with slight alterations here and there. Like, he moved it from New England to Florida for some reason. Most of his stuff, as far as I know, takes place in New England. Now, I don't want to talk too much about Lovecraft, but this is his universe, his literary universe. There is no good God. So what are we left with? A very scary world. This is the first paragraph of his The Call of Cthulhu. And after I read that, I'll move right along. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. It, meaning the world. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto hemmed us little. But someday, the piecing together of disassociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deathly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. So, reality, if we could see the whole of it, would be terribly, terribly frightening. This is the alienated atheist. And by the way, the modern evolutionist who doesn't believe in God, the modern materialist who doesn't believe in God, many of them will honestly tell you they think that the world is a pretty scary place. They'll tell you how ruthless reality is. There is no good in their worldview. There really is no good. Perhaps they get some consolation from their scientific inquiries or whatever. They like it. They're interested in it. But there's no moral good there. And there's no point to moral goodness because there's no reward and there's no punishment. These modern scientists very much have a worldview that I would say is like the literary view that was taken by H.P. Lovecraft. Moving along, the true view of good versus evil is the traditional Christian understanding that we get from Revelation. God created the world to be good. The Hebrew word is tov. And I'll get to it later, but during creation, every time God stops to look at what he did at the work during the work of the 6 days, he saw it and it was tov, it was good. But of course, the fall happened, the fall of man, which was preceded by the fall of the angels. So let's talk then about the very nature of good and evil and what it really is. We've talked about some aberrant views of good and evil, beginning with the Manichaean idea, going to some of the Protestant ideas, going to Nietzsche, and then going to Satanism and then spending probably too long on H.P. Lovecraft. Let's talk then about the nature of good and evil itself. How is it that in creation, in Genesis, God calls his creation, including man, good 7 times? By the way, 7 is not insignificant here. It's the number of a covenant in the old law, and it's the number of perfection in the new law. So if we look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 4, verse 10, verse 12, verse 18, verse 21, verse 25, and verse 31, those 7 times, God says it's good. Yet, Jesus says in the gospel, none is good but God alone. Simply put, God is goodness itself, and he is the source of all good, while a creature is not. God is absolutely good or simply good, while creatures are relatively so and only inasmuch as they participate in God's goodness. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, and we're talking about not beyond good and evil. Now, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, being and good are the same thing, but they may be logically distinguished. That is to say, that we may distinguish them in our thought, even though they are really the same. Aristotle, whom St. Thomas follows here, defined good as that which all things desire. That which all things desire. Another way of putting this is that which is loved for itself. That's what's good. So Aristotle called it that which all things desire. God is self-subsisting being, the only being from itself. It follows that God is the greatest good and is therefore supremely desirable. Saint Jean-Marie Vianney, the curé of Ars, used to refer to God as the good God. It seems very childlike language, but it says so much. Reflecting on God's goodness may help us to simplify many of the complex questions of the day. It may also help us to deal with many of the confused or unhappy aspects of our own life. God is good. Try saying that in the midst of affliction and adversity. It's not always easy, but it's an act of faith. Okay, so earlier I said that God was the source of all good in which creatures participate. I can say analogously that God is good. I can say that Saint Anthony is good. And I could say that salt is good. So that's an analogy. Analogously, I'm predicating good of God, of Saint Anthony, and of salt. Now, salt is good is actually a quote from the Gospels. Our Lord himself said it. So we know it's true. Sal bonum est. Salt is good. In each of these three statements, something is the same while something is very much different. And that is the nature of all analogy. In analogy, something's the same and something's different. Inasmuch as every creature reflects something of the divine goodness that made it, it's good. This remains true even after the fall, as St. Paul affirms when he tells St. Timothy that every creature of God is good, from 1 Timothy 4:4. But if every creature is good, how comes it that evil or sin exists? The short answer is that evil is not a thing, but it is the absence of a thing. Much as cold is the absence of heat, a person or a thing is said to be evil only to the degree that it is missing a perfection it ought to have. Evil is therefore privative, that is to say, it pertains to a deprivation, a lack, an absence. This was one of St. Augustine's great thoughts, and I said I'd get to this, and I have. This is one of St. Augustine's great thoughts, and it helped him to extricate himself from that Manichaean heresy that we described earlier, which wickedly postulated a good God and an evil God that were equal in power. If the good is that which all desire, it is also something we pursue, sometimes well and sometimes badly. We seek goods not only of the body, but also of the mind and of the soul. Most of us, not being saints, stop short of our greatest good and satisfy ourselves with secondary goods. Our Lady of Fatima said that most people go to hell because of sins of the flesh. This is a sobering affirmation of the truth that the bodily good of sex, which is a true good invested with a noble purpose in God's providential designs for our race, becomes sinful when it is sought for the sake of pleasure alone in contradiction to God's law. There, I'm not a Manichaean, right? I mean, I said it's good. It's good. God made it. It's good. But if it's not done according to God's plan, it becomes morally evil. The same can be said of any kind of good, including spiritual goods. The spiritual sin of pride, which is a disordered exaltation of the self, can be far worse than lechery. Okay, Our Lady of Fatima said that most souls go to hell because of the sins of the flesh. She didn't say sins of the flesh are the worst sins. She did not say that, and it doesn't follow. Well, you say, well, you know, if most people go to there, well, then it's worse. Objectively speaking, no, that's not true. Which is worse, a common cold, or Ebola? Which is worse, the flu or again, Ebola, some exotic thing like that, where you bleed from every orifice and you die a miserable death. Well, Ebola's worse, objectively considered, comparing apples to apples. Ebola's worse than the flu. But if it kills you, it doesn't matter how it killed you, right? You're still dead. So the idea is that the mortal sin of the flesh, while it might not be the worst sin, is sufficient to get you to hell. We don't all have to commit a mortal sin of pride in, say, starting a schismatic sect or starting a new heresy. We don't all have to commit some really, really, really celebrated atrocity in order to go to hell. The celebrated atrocity, the mass murderer, the butcher, the serial rapist and murderer, I mean, he's worse than a man who just sort of, sleeps around a little bit, isn't he? But the numbers of people who do the latter far exceed the former. So, there are more of them in hell. That's what it means to say that most sins go to hell for that. It's not to say that it's the worst sin. Now, this is what Our Lady told us, though, that most souls go to sin for that. So any kind of sin, though, any kind of sin that we get ourselves in, that is a mortal sin that contravenes God's law seriously, is enough to get us into hell. Even the aesthete whose life's pursuit is created beauty sins gravely when he puts that pursuit above God, who is the absolute good and who is uncreated beauty. See, the essence of sin is turning away from God and turning towards the creature. That's the essence of sin. That's it. It's not a violation of a completely arbitrary dictate. That's not what sin is. Most people who have no grounding in the Christian revelation or even common sense in these matters think that Christian categories of sin are just arbitrary infractions of meaningless laws generated by somebody else to limit other people. That's not what sin is. It's a turning of one's back on God towards the creature. It's basically saying to God, I'm going to pursue the good of this thing that you created rather than yourself. And how do you do that? Because God created a law where he said, this is the way that my creation is to be enjoyed, and this is the way that it is not to be enjoyed. You do the first, you're fine. You do the second, you're violating my law. And you're harming yourself in the process. The evil of sin entails the use of some creature that is in itself good, but in a way that is contrary to the purpose that God put in it. No man sins simply because sin is evil. In other words, he's not pursuing evil for the sake of evil. Nobody does that. Rather, we sin under the aspect of goodness. This is not to say that we actually think that we're being morally good when we sin. It simply affirms that we're pursuing something that is in itself good, but in a disordered way. So the thief steals because of his attraction to the real bodily good that his sticky fingers grasp. The glutton is overly attached to the good of food, and the drunkard to that of spirits. Yes, spirits are good in due measure. The Puritans, of course, were evil in denying this. The lecher sins by a disordered appetite of the bodily good of the marital act. Even purely spiritual sins, like pride, are directed to something good, that is, our own exaltation, but in a way that is essentially disordered. Now, on the other hand, God is willing to grant us the good of exaltation, but he exalts only the humble. In short, we sin by seeking something good in itself, but contrary to the command of goodness itself, or should I say goodness himself. So this is the true nature of evil. It's a deprivation of a perfection that should exist. It's privative. It's a lack. It's an absence. And if that is the case, then all things that exist, which have been made to be good, if we call them evil, it means that they are substantially lacking in a perfection that should be there. And that is what we're talking about when we talk about sin. It's the absence of a moral perfection that ought to exist. Now, I said if I had time that I hope to get to St. Thomas's objection and his reply. I'm going to do that right now. His objection to God's existence based upon the reality of evil is this. It seems that God does not exist, because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. But the word God means that he is infinite goodness. If, therefore, God existed, there would be no evil discoverable. But there is evil in the world, therefore God does not exist. Now, after giving his arguments for the existence of God, he replies to this objection, and he says this. As Augustine says in his Enchiridion, that is his Handbook on Faith, Hope, and Charity, chapter 11, quote, since God is the highest good, he would not allow any evil to exist in his works, unless his omnipotence and goodness were such as to bring good even out of evil, end quote. And that's Augustine being quoted by St. Thomas. St. Thomas goes on, this is part of the infinite goodness of God, that he should allow evil to exist and out of it produce good. Now, one of my favorite authors, J.R.R. Tolkien, has this in his own sort of creation narrative in the Silmarillion, this sort of Satan figure who's called Morgoth originally and then named Melkor when he becomes really evil. During creation, where these angelic beings of which he is one, the Valar, they're called, where they help God in creating. God is creating, but they're singing this music with God while the material creation is being made. And Melkor keeps putting these discordant notes in the song of creation, so that when the song is finished, and the song itself is something of a prototype of creation, because creation then gets made after the song is sung, God turns to Melkor and corrects him and rebukes him, but he says this. He says, there's no evil that you can do that I can't bring a greater good out of. Now, I'm paraphrasing. It's been a long time since I read it. But Iluvatar, or God, says to Melkor, or the devil character, there's no evil that you can do that I cannot bring a greater good out of. Now, this is Tolkien, who is, I think, very Augustinian in his worldview, putting that into his lore. The devil cannot create, contrary to the Manichaean worldview, where all that is matter is evil because it comes from the evil God. We don't believe that the devil can create. He can create nothing. Nothing. Nothing positive can come from him. All he can do is warp and distort and spoil and tear down. He can't build. He can't make. And he certainly, well, he can make in a sense of fabricate. So can we. But we can't create, right? We can't take something out of nothing and make it to be. He can't either. All he can do is spoil what's there. And that's the notion of evil. It's a corruption of something. It's a corruption of something good. Now, I want to finish by contrasting goodness with holiness. And this is a point of some confusion. To be good, to be called good, a man can follow the natural law and be counted a good man. He doesn't rob, he doesn't steal, he doesn't cheat, he doesn't fornicate, he doesn't cheat on his wife, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He basically follows the Ten Commandments. You know, we can even remove the first three commandments and just look at the others. A man can be sort of naturally good that way. Or you can throw in the first three commandments but not specify the religion. And a man can be naturally good that way, by being true to human nature and the natural law written on his heart. But to be holy is what's necessary for salvation. To go to heaven, we have to be holy. And that's different than good. It's good, but it's good in a supernatural way. We cannot go to heaven by simply being good. To go to heaven, we have to be beyond good and evil, in a sense, by being supernaturally good. And once we achieve that supernatural goodness by sanctifying grace, there is a true morality that we must follow, and if we don't follow it, we can ultimately forfeit our salvation. You've been listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. God bless, and may I keep you.